Welcome to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM. 104. No, we're not on 104 anymore. We're also, though, you can go to cfuv.uvic.ca in Shoutcast. Well, it's enough to make a poor enviro's head spin. Every day seems to bring news of more proposed pipelines and projects in British Columbia, and though the citizenry has overwhelmingly voiced opposition to the new carbon rush sweeping the land, Stephen Harper vows unflinching and unstoppable support. The two best-known project proposals for the province are the so-called twinning of the existing Kinder Morgan pipeline that has, until now, quietly issued tar sands product all the way from Alberta's satanic mills, disgorging at Vancouver, and the proposed creation of the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline that hopes to see the tar sands goo transported to Kitimat, where it will then be shipped through treacherous fjords and the inland islands en route to China's insatiable industrial maw, and perhaps to CarMed, California, too. Lesser known than these, though, is the Pacific Trail Pipeline, designed to facilitate gas fracked from BC's northeast. Last week, the caravan to Wet'suwet'en launched from towns and cities across BC and throughout North America to converge at the Pacific Trail Enbridge Northern Gateway right-of-way. Rod Marining is a longtime environment defender, a co-founder of Greenpeace International, navigator of the Sea Shepherd vessels Farley Mowat and Steve Irwin, among others, chair of the BC Environmental Network, listserv manager of the Land Watch campaign, and coordinator for PATH, or People's Action for Threatened Habitats. Rod departed with the caravan to Wet'suwet'en from the Lower Mainland last week and joins us in the first segment. And last week, details about the source of Mitt Romney's great wealth broke. Mitt, it turns out, accepted millions to set up his vulture capital fund from the first families of El Salvador at the height of the dirty wars there in the 1980s. A footnote in U.S. policy atrocity, perhaps, but the death squad terror supported by Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and businesses like Mitt Romney's Bain Capital set the stage for the horror to follow in Iraq and across the Middle East. Robert Perry broke many of the Iran-Contra stories in the 1980s for the Associated Press and Newsweek. His latest book, Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush, was written with his two sons, Sam and Nat, and can be ordered at neckdeepbook.com. His two previous books are Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, and Lost History, Contras, Cocaine, and the Press, and Project Truth, revisiting Robert Perry and the Death Squad legacy of Latin America in the second segment. And Victoria Street News publisher and CFUV radio broadcaster Janine Bancroft will join us at the bottom of the hour to bring us news from Victoria Streets and far, far beyond. But first, Rod Marining and the caravan to Wet'suwet'en and resistance in an age of environmental madness. Stick around. Well, I got some bad news. It's summertime here, which isn't the bad news, but it's kind of hard news for programmers like me. Yeah, you guessed it. Rod is not connecting right now, but I'm going to keep trying. And until I can get Rod on the line, what I'm going to do is I'll play a little tune and I'll set up the computers and stuff because I do have a backup plan going here, but it's not exactly primed. But in the meantime, why don't you enjoy some music from an old favorite band of mine, Asian Dub Foundation, a British band, eclectic, they say.
Every Sunday morning in front
Oh yeah, Asian Dub Foundation from their disc, Community Music, a terrific disc. There's not a bad cut on it. Well, as things have it, you know, it's a, it is a community, and Come to My Rescue is an old friend of this program. Been on very many times before. Igmar Lee up in the Great Bear Rainforest. Hey, Igmar, how's it going?
Pretty good. How are you, Chris?
Well, I'm doing all right, and thanks a lot for jumping into the breach to save me. Now, you said, oh, I can hear your little Zephyr there in the background.
Yeah.
You were saying to me that you ran into Rod, actually. Can you tell me the details?
Well, we were at the farcical, cowardly Stephen Harper joint review panel hearings. We're here in Shearwater last week, and Rod just happened to show up, and so he came over, and we had a couple of beers, and we hung out all day and half the night.
And he was on his way then up to Wet'suwet'en, or
I guess he was. Yeah, he left from here up to Bella Coola, and I don't know what happened to him after that. But I think he's on somewhere out in the bush there in Wet'suwet'en right now.
Yeah, I guess that's why I can't get him on his cell phone. I don't know. I guess the cell service might not be so great up there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did tell us an incredible story though while he was here, and we were talking about that, you know, it would be nice to have the first annual Douglas Channel sailing regatta, you know, and get, you know, 200 or 300 sailboats up there and just sail back and forth across the channel for a few days. And, you know, of course, sailboats have the right of way over, you know, gigantic VLCCs or whatever, condensate tankers and things that are already plying the channel. And Rob said, oh, well, we already did that in 1977. And he described this big tanker that had 400 oil executives on it, or some great mass of oil executives, and they were checking out Douglas Channel as a possible entry port for Alaskan oil tankers, like, you know, the Exxon Valdez, for example.
Yeah.
There was a scheme to actually deliver oil from Alaska right into Kitimat through Douglas Channel, and then off to a pipeline that would ship it down to the United States. So I guess Rod was in a Greenpeace Zodiac with another fellow, and they were bumping up against the bow of this great big tanker, and the tanker was trying to veer around the other blockading boats. This is 1977. You know, Douglas Channel's obviously got a long history of being you know, in the minds of the big oil.
Mm-hmm.
As the tanker was trying to maneuver, it put its bow thruster in full reverse and managed to suck their Zodiac down. And the Zodiac sort of folded in half and almost got sucked them right into the prop. And Rod and his buddy were ejected, and he described bouncing down alongside of the tanker and seeing the lettering at the towards the stern that said "Beware of, you know, prop," and somehow they made it through the prop wash and nearly drowned, and were rescued by some of the Gitgat First Nations, those people that you know, saved the lives of the sunken Queen of the North passengers.
Right, right. Well, and which wasn't far from the Douglas Channel. Maybe you should describe, Igmar, for those of us that don't know, you know, what is the outlay of the Douglas Channel, and why is it so important to these plans for the tar sands?
Well, the Douglas Channel is a very long fjord that runs from the central coast up to Kitimat. And, of course, there's all the kerfuffle in BC about the northern, well, I call it the Stephen Harper pipeline tanker scheme, because let's face it, let's recognize its chief proponent. So the Stephen Harper pipeline was slated to go, you know, 1,300 kilometers from the tar sands to Kitimat, and then, you know, just literally, I mean, you want to talk about traffic jam, there's some of 200 odd gigantic tankers. Now we're talking, you know, larger than you know, they're the size of the Empire State Building.
Right.
Now these would be in addition to the several hundred condensate tankers that would be going the other way every year, and this would be in addition to the proposed LNG tankers that are slated to be plying that waterway. I mean, we're talking a very narrow long, torturous fjord. And then once you get out to sea, there's a whole archipelago of islands with, you know, rocks. I mean, you can't let down your guard for a minute operating a boat up here. You need to be fully aware at all times because there's just, you know, rocks and reefs and all kinds of, you know, currents. And, you know, last winter we had 4 storms in excess of 100-knot winds. That's, you know, just 100 knots. That's about 140-mile-an-hour winds. So, you know, the whole thing is just a recipe for disaster.
Well, I can see the shape of this, you know, would act like a venturi of a sort with the winds coming in off the Pacific and running up the Douglas Channel. What kind of wind conditions do they normally see up and down the channel?
Well, I mean, you know, in the summer it's fairly placid, but storms just come out of the blue, and there's outflow winds, this ice-cold outflow winds that ice up all the, you know, huge lumps of ice all over your decks and rigging and stuff like that in the winter. And then, you know, southeasters and all kinds of incredible whooshing winds and terrible navigation conditions. I mean, even in this current edition of Western Mariner, there's a very senior ship's captain that describes these pitfalls. And his conclusion, he starts off by saying, you know, he's not opposed to transporting oil and tankers and that sort of thing. But his final conclusion is that it's just lunacy to the scheme of the project. And of course, you know, one assumes that BC Ferries has like the, you know, state-of-the-art navigation equipment and the most highly trained ship's personnel and watchkeepers and all the bells and whistles that, you know, you'd expect to be able to navigate a craft with, you know, the public. And, you know, they sank a ferry just off of Douglas Channel.
Well, and the Queen of the North had gone back and forth up and down that route like umpteen times. And even with that highly experienced crew and all the equipment that you mentioned, it still ended up on the bottom.
Absolutely. But, you know, Chris, all this talk about the Northern Gateway, personally, having listened to all the farcical, cowardly, shamefully disgraceful joint review panel that's just come through here and insulted the Haltzik First Nation, I mean, they arrived in Bella Bella for the first hearings and got off the plane, and there was like about 200 kids and families. You know, I was there with our baby and my family and standing on the side of the road with the colorful banners and everything. It was just a boisterous, cheerful, colorful event, and they were bustled through the crowd with an RCMP escort into town, where they were met by all of the Haltzik chiefs in their resplendent regalia. And they deked around them, gave them their backs, and ran away over to Shearwater on the adjacent island after they'd been invited to a community feast. And, you know, we've just heard recently that the Enbridge contingent was recently up in, I believe it was Wet'suwet'en, and, you know, one of the very respectful and traditional things to do with visitors is that, you know, there's eagle down. There's a sprinkling of eagle down that's a very benign and friendly gesture. And they were insulted because they thought they were being pelted by feathers. I mean, personally, I think they should be tarred and feathered. But it just goes to show how ignorant these people are. I mean, I don't know what they're getting from Burson Marsteller and Hill Knowlton, their public relations money. I mean, they're probably spending the biggest bucks that they could possibly spend for public relations, and these people are that ignorant. I mean, everybody knows that Eagle Down is not a disrespectful thing. But anyway, this panel is, see, the thing about the Enbridge Gateway, and I want to make this point, and this is very something that has become clear to me. I believe it's a false feint all along. Now, if you're going to build a 20-story condo tower in Victoria, the standard modus operandi is for a developer is that you put in to build a 40-story condo tower. And then you sit back and you watch the predictable backlash, and you watch the tree huggers and everybody dancing around and freaking out and everything, and you wait a couple of weeks, and then you say, well, we've listened, we've consulted, we've heard the experts, and, you know, I think we'll scale back our request to a 20-story condo tower, right? So I think that if their public relations experts, their PR spinmeisters, had a plan, they would, you know, pick the ecological heart center of the BC environmental community, the First Nations community, and target the Great Bear Rainforest as the final destination of the Dirty Oil Stephen Harper pipeline. And then you sit back, you watch everybody burn themselves out. I mean, people out here are just absolutely frantic with concern over this nightmare. And I think then what we're going to see is that there'll be an announcement that, well, you know, Enbridge, you know, they fucked up, and they, you know, they're the Keystone Cops, and they're just a hopeless corporation that can't, you know, and the whole idea to kit them out is just an idiotic, stupid idea, and that actually they'd rather put it through to Vancouver down the Friendly pipeline, Kinder Morgan. And I think that's the ultimate goal of this whole charade. I don't believe that the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline will go through. I think it's been defeated. I think it was never their intention was to put it through there. I think the whole thing, this is all just a build-up. They predicted, anybody would have predicted a backlash in British Columbia. They know that British Columbians are opposed to oil and gas development off the coast. They're opposed to dirty oil pipelines. And they're desperate to get their oil out, and I think they want to carry it out through Vancouver. And they know they were in for a rough ride. And what you do is you get the community all excited, you get them distracted and pointing north. And I think this would have been the plan of any intelligent public relations spinmeister, that, you know, the best that big oil can buy. Right. So, you know, it's I think it's a false feint, the whole thing.
Well, yeah, but I mean, then what's in it for Enbridge, unless, you know, unless Kinder Morgan and Enbridge are related, or if they've got some kind of deal, because Enbridge is spending the money and taking all the heat, right? And what do they get out of it?
Enbridge isn't spending the money. They've got 10 enormous funders that are paying their PR bill, which is probably about 1 minute profit through a future pipeline. This money isn't coming from Enbridge. They haven't even listed their funders. I mean, we don't know who's paying for it. I think it's like Sinopec and Canuck, or you know, the Chinese National Offshore Oil Company or whatever it is that's paying for it. But I think the ultimate goal is to ram it through Vancouver, and I think that people of British Columbia should be certainly continue to work towards shutting down this idiotic Stephen Harper pipeline project, but they should realize that and save their energy for the big fight, which is going to be to stop the Kinder Morgan disaster.
Well, yeah, and of course, you know, after they publicly backed down on one, then it makes the environmentalists seem unreasonable not to allow a second one to go through. I was going to talk to Rod about the Pacific Trail Pipeline, the so-called, and this is where these guys have gone up to Wet'suwet'en to, you know, where the right-of-way, this is like an estimated 3 kilometer wide gash where, you know, these different pipelines will converge. And it might explain a little bit here, because according to Rod, he says, quote, there are 8 pipelines at the Morris River area planned, 2 for Enbridge and 2 for Pacific Trail Pipeline, and Apache and Canna and EOG. Do you know who EOG is? Is that Enbridge?
No, I don't. I think that it's unfortunate that the Pacific Trails project seems to have been surreptitiously working its way through the farcical procedures that there are. However, it seems that it's been given a bit of a green light by some of the First Nations communities along the way. I don't know. I've certainly known about this pipeline for a while. It seems that it's new to a lot of people, but it was out there and it was announced, and I think Gordon Campbell was bragging about it, during his reign of disaster. I think that Gordon Campbell is probably the main culprit in trying to sneak this this pipeline stuff through British Columbia, and I believe he's currently employed over in England trying to soften the opposition to it too, or to promote it.
Yeah,
it's just, the whole thing is such a scandal.
Well, according to Rod again on this, he says the Pacific Trails Pipeline Limited Partnership, PTPLP, is a partnership between managing operator Apache with 40% interest in EOG Resources Canada Inc. I still don't know who those are, and Encana Corporation, each holding 30%. And I think he mentioned somewhere in this letter that Enbridge does have an in on this, and it does have a piece of the Pacific Trail. So, you know, they might be getting what they want, but getting it from a different angle. And as you say, a stalking horse being run down the center, because that coming down the Douglas Channel and onto the Bear Coast. I mean, when you see Enbridge's little, you talked about their PR, well, they have this little cartoony film showing cartoony maps that just, they come out of the Douglas Channel into the wide Pacific, and hey, what happened to Vancouver Island, and what happened to all the other islands? They all just disappear, and it's like a straight on a subway ride to China, right?
Oh, it's the whole thing is just an absolute disaster. There's not a single person up here that's supportive of this thing, and we've just had another poll. I forget, it was an Ipsos Reid or one of those lackey pollsters that puts it at, you know, that 60% of British Columbians are opposed to it, and I think that number is a lot higher. I think Stephen Harper is in big trouble over this. I think he's trying to backpedal and distance himself from the thing, because I think if anybody believes in polls, it's like the Christie Clarks and Stephen Harpers of the world, and you can bet your boots that he's got all of, you know, they're probably doing daily polling on it, and he can smell the reality, and that people, and that they're just going to have, they've got a growing fight in British Columbia, and I don't think British Columbians are going to stand for it, and I know that people around here are absolutely not going to allow this thing to happen.
Well, you mentioned, Ingmar, the review process, and as I recall, when the JRP was in your neck of the woods, up at Bella Bella there, there was somebody had slapped the hand or something on the van as they were coming from the airport, and this triggered a huge, massive security lockdown, and, you know, they even reports of shots being fired hit the national press. But another thing that I heard just recently with the JRP up in Comox is they did the same thing. There was this emergency shutdown when one of the speakers, and people have to register and they prepare for months and months in some cases. Well, this guy stood up, and I've forgotten the name, Stewart, Chief Stewart something, but he started quoting this First Nations elder, this chief, who had said basically to the effect that he and his people were going to stand with their backs to the wall to oppose this thing. Well, that was taken as a direct threat, and under their under their guidelines, any uttering of threats, you know, triggers an immediate lockdown, and the arbiters are whisked away. Have you heard about this?
Well, you know, I spoke at the recent hearing here in Shearwater because they were too afraid to go to Bella Bella, and Bella Bella is an extremely welcoming, gracious, and friendly community, and these people insulted the Heiltsuk Nation by not even holding the hearings in Bella Bella, the oral presentations. They had them over at Shearwater in our community hall, and there wasn't enough room in there. There was, like, people standing up. There was police everywhere. The police came and just hassled everybody around here. We rarely see police around here, and, you know, suddenly the island's crawling with cops, and I got my mic shut off twice during my testimony. And, the Joint Review Panel, like, if they had the slightest bit of integrity, and if they were had any possibility of impartiality and that they were even considering a favorable decision on opposing the pipeline, if they had that kind of conscience, they should just immediately resign, because the Prime Minister's already told them that it doesn't matter what their decision is, he'll overrule it. If they have an ethical, conscientious decision, the Prime Minister will overrule it. So all they're doing is sitting back, collecting a paycheck, and quite a considerable paycheck, and they are wasting everybody's time. The Joint Review Panel is just an utter waste of time, and it breaks my heart to hear the impassioned and magnificent testimony that people are making to these idiots. And I'm sorry, but that's what these people are. They're unqualified. They have absolutely no qualification. They're disrespectful. They're insulting. And they're just a bunch of Stephen Harper puppets. I mean, they are appointed by the Stephen Harper government.
Well, what about these testimonies? Are they being archived somewhere where people can access them, or do they just go into the black hole of bureaucracy?
No, they are being archived, and they're all they all can be accessed, and you can go and read them over. It's a rather obtuse website, and it's a bit tricky. I had to actually phone to find out where, because I searched. I wasted like an hour of my time trying to find the testimony. But I would like to, you know, I'm very curious to know how many times have they been shutting people's mics off, because, right. You know, what I said was, I mean, as far as, you know, the terms of reference go, we were entitled to express our concerns and our personal feelings, and that's what I did, and they shut my mic off. Now, last time, you commonly hear, this is Canada, we have free speech here. Well, if these people are going around shutting people's mics off all across BC, that's an infringement of our rights, and I think it's probably should be a class action lawsuit against the Joint Review Panel process. It's just I've just, words fail me to describe how pathetic this whole business is.
Well, finally, Aidmore, when you talk about red herrings and people's limited energy to organize and resist some of the more harmful effects, it occurs to me that really what this is about, I mean, the inland damage to creeks and watersheds and habitat by these huge pipelines is one thing, but really the ocean is, it seems to me, where everything comes, whether that pipeline goes to Kitimat or whether it goes to Vancouver. It's the coast of, it's our coastline here and the wild ocean and the animals and creatures in it that we're really concerned about. Do you think,
Chris,
that we can focus on...
I'd have to beg to differ with you on that point, because the whole thing from start to finish is disastrous for the whole world. The whole process of extracting the dirty oil from the area around Fort McMurray has polluted the Athabasca Mackenzie River system, the 10th largest watershed in the world. It's destroying and it's Canada's largest greenhouse gas emitter, just the processing of this dirty oil. Then to transport it all across BC risks just countless river systems and watersheds. Then to run it through the Pacific Ocean, even, you know, and the worst part of it being right here in the Great Barrier Rainforest, the most treacherous waters I've seen anywhere in the world, and then to ship it all the way to China, where the running all of that dirty oil through the internal combustion engine, the whole thing is a planet killer right from start to finish. If Stephen Harper wants to make the argument that the tar sands and developing the tar sands is in Canada's national interest and it's absolutely essential for Canada's economy. And by the way, Stephen Harper came to BC on numerous occasions during the last election and never once uttered a peep about the pipeline. And then now it's become a national emergency for him. You know, if he wants to make the argument that this is essential, why doesn't he just say, you want energy, you want our Canadian energy, build it in Fort McMurray. Send all the industry to Fort McMurray. Build a 20-lane highway to Fort McMurray and make stuff there. and then ship it out. And then we'd have all the manufacturing jobs. We'd have, you know, well, we'd utterly destroy the Arctic Ocean and the Mackenzie River system and all that. I'm not arguing for that myself. But if Stephen Harper had an ethical bone in his body, that's what he'd be doing. You know, this shipping out dirty oil, it's just like shipping raw logs. Yeah. It just ships jobs out of Canada and over to China. And then it comes back here, and we'd buy it here. So, you know, these tankers would be going over there, and they'd be making all that stuff and then bringing it back here. You know, it's just ridiculous. Why not just make it here? Canada should be an industrial mega power if Stephen Harper's vision of the world had any ethics in it. You know,
well, as in the larger sense, yeah, the project, real environmentalists argue that the project has to be shut down.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that could happen?
Well, I think this is the start, and this goes into a whole other avenue of discussion. I believe that the backlash, the growing backlash against the dirty oil, the Stephen Harper dirty oil pipeline, is gaining so much momentum. And I look all around the world, and the progressive movement is gaining momentum. And I believe that, you know, I don't know what it takes for it to suddenly explode into action, but, you know, we're seeing signs of it. The Occupy movement, the progressive movement is a majority in the world, and we are still figuring out the processes by which we can exercise our power. I mean, we're anarchists. We don't recognize the corrupt excuse for democracy that we've got in Canada that puts an asshole like Stephen Harper in power with less than 30% of the vote. Mm-hmm. I mean, with a so-called majority government with less than 30% of the vote. And the guy cheated his way into power with all these robocalls and just scams, you know. And so the progressive movement, I believe, is just learning how to exercise its power. And, you know, if there's any hope for this planet, you know, it's going to be that the progressive movement will begin to gain control of this nightmare and turn it around. I'm not seeing it happening fast enough, but that's what it would take to shut the tar sands down, and I sure hope it happens soon.
Well, Igmar Lee, thanks a lot for coming on and covering my ass again on this show, standing in for Rod Mariner, who I'm sure is out of cell range somewhere up in the interior there. Now, luckily for us, I know that Janine is with you. I'm going to take a 25-second break to do some business, some housekeeping here, and then you can pass the phone on to Janine. Would you do that for me, Igmar?
You bet, Chris.
Okay, well, thanks
very
again.
Nice talking to you.
Yeah, it's always good.
Bye.
And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM, cfuv.uvic.ca on the interweb, everywhere else. Joining me now is oftentimes she does, but not from where she often does, is Victoria Street News publisher and CFUV radio broadcaster in her own right, Janine Bancroft. Hey, Janine.
Chris, I'm off away up here in the Great Bear Rainforest. I've kind of forgot how big the world is.
Yeah, you took the boat ride up there, the cheapest cruise going, right?
Oh, man, no kidding. Well, the $100, you know, from Port Hardy, and I got on the ferry at 9:30 at night, and I got to Shearwater at 10:15 or something the next morning. It's an amazing ride, and, I mean, it's so beautiful. You know, you've been here, and it's so refreshing to not see any clear cuts.
Yeah,
rare is that on our island and around where we live, right?
Well, we're surrounded by trees and you just get used to it. But that was the thing that struck me first as well when I went up there, was you're looking at all of this totally primordial forests and uninterrupted, no, and hardly a sign of people at all.
Yeah, it's fantastic. There's way too many fish killers, I would say, up here. And interestingly, there's a resident bear who's been breaking into people's freezers. So I don't know if he's got wind that they're all these fisher people taking his fish, but there are definitely a lot of fishers. I've as a vegan, I brought enough food for a few days here, and you know, you can almost get the sensation that everything is unlimited. You know, unlimited forests, unlimited fish, but of course, you know, it's important to remember that that's not quite the case. And I'm only, you know, part way up. I mean, it's amazing how huge this province really is. And on the way, Chris, I took the bus from Victoria up to Port Hardy, and there was a woman on the bus with all the granny sort of pins and paraphernalia, and sure enough, she had been at the Granny's Unconvention. You know, they hold these every 2 years, and our grannies in Victoria are the original grannies, and this being the 25th year of grannydom, they actually organized this incredible convention, unconvention, last weekend. And so this woman was telling me about it, and they had Elizabeth May as their keynote speaker, and we're all very impressed with Elizabeth. And then, as they do every year, the Raging Grannies organized the Hiroshima Nagasaki Memorial on the 9th. This year, and so all these over 100 grannies from North America attended that. And during the day, they had been bussed around and stopped outside the museum, and all loaded off the bus and drew chalk drawings outside the BC Museum there. And she said that they awarded sort of prizes or whatever, or some recognition for the grannies who traveled the most environmentally friendly ways, and the winners were cyclists from Seattle, which is pretty incredible. Grandmas, these two that I met had a woman and her husband had taken the train from Ontario and were on their way up through Hartley Bay and up to Haida Gwaii here. And she said that in the U.S., the U.S. grannies mentioned that their main concern is fracking and, of course, health care. And then there was a lot of talk about the pipeline, there's a huge limestone project apparently in northern Ontario where they bought a bunch of land. Some corporation bought a bunch of land and said they were going to continue to grow potatoes on this land. And then it turns out that they actually want to dig a hole deeper than Niagara Falls and do this limestone project. So that's a major concern. And you know what she said is that pretty much all the grannies agreed that, you know, their kind of attitude is, well, we're going to die anyway. So they're ready to go out and be on the front lines and you know, stop the bulldozers.
Well, yeah, we ran into Fran, one of the grannies up here at the university. I missed the great hoedown. I'd hope to get some tape, but I was not on the ball on that one. But, yeah, is that the project that Sarah Harmer sings about? I've forgotten the word of it now. The escarpment? Is that the limestone thing in Ontario?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm going to do some more investigating about that one, yeah.
Okay. Wow, and so, well, tell me more. Now, you're up in the Great North feeling the fresh air. Have you gauged the political opinions of any of the people that live up there yet?
No, I haven't been anywhere. I'm staying, you know, with Ingmar and Krista. They're very graciously hosting me here, and yesterday was sunny and beautiful, and I was able to go for a little sailing ride with Dev. Took me out on a little sailing tour, and today that we were kind of talking about kayaking, but it's pouring rain. Of course, we could still go yet, I don't know, but I'm just enjoying, you know, being in the rainforest and not doing anything, quite frankly. It's nice just to have a couple of days off the grid. You know, there's no Wi-Fi, there's no cell towers, I don't think. Are there cell towers? No, there's no cell towers. It's just, you know, it's just nice to be away.
Wow. Okay. Well. All right. Well, Janine, then your program, Alternating Thursdays, right here, The Winds of Change, 11 a.m. You've been off the air because of the summer camp thing. When are you back on?
I'm on the 30th.
The 30th of August, you'll be back. Okay.
Right.
And of course, the Victoria Street News. You've been selling them like hotcakes this summer so far with your super salespeople, and now September's out, right?
September's there, and if people are interested in reading back issues, they're all online at Relative News. That's news with a Z.ca.
Okay, Janine, well, thanks a lot for coming on, and safe journeys, and enjoy the wild splendor of the Central Coast.
I certainly will. Thank you, Chris.
All right, then, Janine, until the next time. All right, now I'm going to take a brief musical break, and then when I come back, a little something from a former guest, Robert Perry. You know, as I say, summertime is always it's always tough, and August is the toughest of all to get booked. You know, people are on holidays and whatnot. But this is a pertinent piece, and I'll tell you why when we come back.
propaganda. If truth is your pressure, then come join the bounty hunters. Truth making the enemy of all these liars. Books, them are bent on documents are shredded. Cover ups are covered up for the name of the law. Pushing down so I have to get on the court where that need. What no mercy for 50 years or more.
Ah, yes, and that's Asian Dub Foundation from Community Music, Memory War. That's, of course, from Orwell. Well, remembering, last week, details about the source of Mitt Romney's great wealth broke. Mitt, it turns out, accepted millions to set up his Vulture Capital Fund from the first families of El Salvador at the height of the dirty wars there in the 1980s, a footnote in U.S. policy atrocities. Perhaps, but the death squad terror supported by Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and businesses like Mitt Romney's, Bain Capital, set the stage for the horror to follow in Iraq and across the Middle East. Robert Perry, he's an old-time investigative journalist and founder of the news site Consortium News. Perry broke many of the Iran-Contra stories in the 80s for the Associated Press and Newsweek when those organizations were bothering with such things. His latest book is Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush, and you can order that at neckdeepbook.com. And his two other books are Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, and Lost History, Contras, Cocaine, the Press, and Project Truth. This is I did an interview with Robert. Let me check the date here. This is up on my site, pacificfreepress.com. And you can go to the Guerrilla Radio tab and get past shows. And this one's from July 13th, 2009. God, how the time passes. Now, here's Robert Perry, with a little bit of background on Mr. On the source of Mr. Romney's great wealth. It seems that what's old is new again in Central America. I mean, does the recent coup in Honduras compare with the bad old days of Reagan's dirty doings in Latin America that you covered, Bob?
Well, I'm not sure it compares. I think one can say that it is an outgrowth. There has been there was this effort a number of years in Latin America to use U.S. influence against any movement that was considered somewhat leftist, populist, radical, pro-communist, whatever you want to call them, to make sure that there would not be another Cuba in the region. So you had this U.S. policy that really dates back many, many years, going back to the 50s and 60s, to use almost whatever means were necessary, including supporting some very abusive, corrupt governments and military regimes to prevent these kinds of leftist political movements from succeeding. And in a way, what you're seeing now in Honduras is somewhat of a throwback to that, in that some of the people involved in the coup against Zelaya were also people who over the years had been involved in these anti-communist struggles, especially back in the 1980s. So you're seeing a bit of almost a deja vu moment, if you will, in Honduras with this kind of intervention against a populist, democratically elected president who was challenging some of the economic positions of the families in Honduras who have dominated that country's politics.
Well, there seemed, Bob, to be some dissonance in the first statements coming out of the White House regarding the coup in Honduras. It's 2 weeks ago now. When you were covering the dirty wars and all the goings on during Reagan's reign, there was always a hint that maybe Ronald Reagan really wasn't quite with it, and that a lot of this stuff was actually going on without his actually knowing about it. You know, basically, I think the assumption was that George Bush was really the de facto president. Is there a sense here that Obama is sort of out of the loop on this one? Because, you know, the different comments coming from first him and then Hillary Clinton and others in the administration?
Well, it's an interesting question. I by the way, do think that Ronald Reagan was much more attuned to what was happening than some people believe. It is also true that George H.W. Bush, his vice president, was an important figure in overseeing a variety of foreign policy issues. So I think both of those points are important. I mean, Reagan was not a naive on this. He was a person who cared a great deal about what was going on there and was willing to essentially lie about what was going on to sell it to the American people more effectively. There was a point when he was talking about even the Nicaraguan Contras, of course, were originally based in Honduras, and he would tell the American people they were freedom fighters. Privately, he would refer to them as vandals. So Ronald Reagan knew what was going on. He just was very willing to mislead the public about it. As far as Obama, I think Obama probably was caught somewhat off guard by this. It certainly does not serve his general interest to have this development in Honduras, especially when he's been lecturing other people about the qualities of their democracies. But you also see in some of the comments from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that there's a sense that there's still the old way going on in Washington, which is to feel sympathy, empathy, if you will, for these oligarchs, the political establishment in countries like Honduras. These are people that have had long relations with the United States. Many of them have gone to school in the United States. They have friends here. They're well connected in the Washington power circles. So there's a tendency to sympathize with their complaints, whereas Zelaya's support was more with the poor people of Honduras. Those are folks that have traditionally not been given a great deal of concern by Washington because people in Washington don't know them. I've covered a number of countries, including places like Haiti, where the elites, the oligarchs, have extremely good connections in Washington. They know many of the right people. They often they've even married into some of the powerful families of the United States. So there's this inbred sort of sympathy for them, and you're seeing that, I think, come out in some of the less harsh rhetoric about the coup plotters than, say, what you heard when you had the situation in Iran, where there were complaints about the accuracy of the election. The United States, many of the U.S. officials, let loose with barrages of condemnation. In the case of Honduras, it's been much more soft-pedaled, and I think that is a reflection of the general feelings of the foreign policy elite in Washington. They just don't. They have a great deal of sympathy for the old ruling elites in that region, and not much for those who want to challenge it.
Well, this looked for all the world to me, as the Honduran thing was unfolding, it was very reminiscent of what happened in Venezuela in 2002, and the major media in the United States and Britain were soft peddling the effects of this, the anti-democratic nature of this, and then comes Obama with this condemnation that seems so out of step. And I think it seemed to me that everybody was sort of pausing and sort of like, well, who's on first here with this whole thing, and now it seems to be writing itself towards its anti-democratic conclusion with some sort of bogus brokered talks in Costa Rica, where they originally had taken the president, presumably with a potato sack over his head. What about the press reaction to this, and is Obama headed for some kind of confrontation with America's press elite, or was he just out? Was he just sort of not on this day?
Well, I think he was responding based on the facts. That is, that there has been this an encouraging trend toward democracy in the Western Hemisphere, and in some cases that has led to populists taking control of governments. People like Chavez in Venezuela, who have challenged the economic structure. They've often nationalized resources. In the case of Venezuela, they've taken even a greater hand in the oil industry. And these are not popular positions among many of the wealthy American business community, because this cuts into their profits at times. So you have that kind of hostility toward these populist movements. And I think what Obama was sort of speaking initially in reaction to the whole idea of democracy, mm-hmm. and that if you have a democratically elected government, it should be allowed to serve out its term. There wasn't really any chance that Zelaya was going to really extend his term. That wasn't even really in the cards. But he had offended the elites in Honduras. The press was against him, and the wealthy folks were against him. But initially, Obama was reacting on the grounds that democracy should be allowed to prevail. Then the foreign policy establishment of the United States kind of weighed in and said, well, you know, he's close to Chavez in Venezuela, who's given us a hard time, and there was more of that tone to it. And then it became, we don't want bloodshed. We want to see if this can be negotiated. So what you're now seeing is kind of a slow rolling of the situation, much like we saw in Haiti when there was the overthrow of Aristide, who was the democratically elected president, very popular with the poor people. And he was ousted, and there were efforts to bring him back, and then he was ousted again later. And there was a sense inside the United States that, well, you know, he kind of deserved it. He wasn't following sort of the free market economic principles that we like. So you can't really fault the people in charge for getting rid of him. And that seems to be kind of the tone we're now hearing when you listen to Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, talking in terms of, oh, let's see if this can be worked out without any more bloodshed. What that really is kind of saying is that Zelaya will probably not get back into power, that there will be inconsequential negotiations, and the idea of really coming down hard on the Honduran coup plotters will be put off until there will be a new election and maybe someone else more acceptable will be approved and put into power. So I think what you're seeing from Obama was originally kind of a reaction to the whole idea that democracy is being overthrown, but now you're seeing more of the traditional U.S. foreign policy approach.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, and around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca on the internet. I'm speaking tonight with Robert Perry, and Bob is a freelance journalist and author whose own experiences encompass the dirty wars in Latin America during the reign of terror of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush in the 1980s. He's the founder of the web news site consortiumnews.com. His book titles include Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, and Lost History, Contras, Cocaine, The Press, and Project Truth. Well, Bob, of course, Iran has been in the news concurrent with South Central America in this context. What about Iran and its connection through, as you've written about in your book, Lost History, and does this strike you as being a little bit of deja vu all over again?
In terms of Iran?
Well, as Iran is popping up again, as we're talking about Latin America and this idea of democracy and revolution.
Well, the United States has a very mixed. I don't like to say this in the United States, but the truth is we have a very mixed and often dark record in terms of dealing with democracy. There have been many now well documented cases of the United States overthrowing democratically elected governments because they were taking economic positions that weren't approved by people in power. Whether you go to the 53 coup in Iran because Mossadegh, the democratically elected prime minister, was trying to nationalize some of the oil companies, 54 in Guatemala because of the democratically elected government there was infringing on some of the United Fruit properties. 73 in Chile because the government of Allende was moving the country in a somewhat of a leftist or more socialist position. You see this over and over again where the United States has intervened, and we always act as if those were anomalies, but they're not really anomalies when you see them happening so often. the United States, especially the press corps, likes to take also a great deal of sort of righteous purity when you see a badly run elections in countries we don't like, or that elect leaders we don't like. It's often ironic that even when in 2000, when we saw right in front of our eyes the theft of an American presidential election, where one guy who actually won both in terms of the national vote, and if all the legally cast votes in Florida had been allowed to be counted, he would have won there too, Al Gore. But instead, through a variety of rather bizarre and anti-democratic moves, George W. Bush got the White House.
And that was Robert Perry from an interview I did with him 3 years ago now, talking about his work in Latin America during the 1980s. And, of course, I played that in honor of Mitt Romney, who owes his great wealth to the bloodshed by the oligarchs of El Salvador and their internecine networks of death squad operators and so on, and their enablers in Washington, D.C., and in the business world, as he proved to be so effective. And in today's Washington, I don't know that they might not use that as a plus for selling him as ruthless enough to be president of the United States. I don't know what it takes these days, but I got to go. Arnold's coming straight up with Rhythm Ning. I'm going to play
that
commercial.
Election.
Oops, I'm not, shut up, Bob. I'm going to play an election, a commercial here, if I can get it up. And for myself.
I'm Dr. Joey Only. When I'm in Victoria, I listen to Guerrilla Radio on 101.9 FM, CFUV Radio.
Yeah, good old Joey Only.
Hi, everybody.
Hey, okay, enough out of you, Joey. Jeez, everything's coming at me twice. Okay, well, as I said, that's the end of the show for this week. Thanks to Igmar Lee, especially, for coming in and covering my butt there. I did hear from Rod Marining. He was apologetic, but, you know, he's up in the north right now. And this, the vagaries of modern technology interrupted our ability to talk today. But I'm going to book him for next week, and we'll see if we can make a good go of it next week, because he's got a lot to tell us, he tells me. Thanks to Janine, too, for coming on the show. Robert Perry, though he doesn't know it. And hey, how about thanks to Asian Dub Foundation? Stick around for Rhythm and Name with Arnold, or maybe his replacement next. For the future.